You're listening to the Triangle Radio Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the November 2018 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part A. Now, here's the continuation of this month's cover story, The Technicolor World of Michael B. Jordan, by Joe Hagan. Jordan's mother grew up in Newark in the 60s and 70s, studying painting at Newark Arts High, the first performing arts public high school in America, whose alumni include Sarah Vaughan, Wayne Shorter, and Savion Glover, and later Michael B. Jordan, who attended for 2 years. As a teenager, she painted her bedroom walls in the colors of the Pan-African flag, red, black, and green, in sympathy with the Committee for a Unified Newark, a black nationalist group founded by poet Amiri Baraka. We would go by, and we would see the guys in the berets and the army fatigues as we were going home from school, she says. At Arts High, her interest ran to ballet and theater. She loved the soundtrack to West Side Story, but she was also part of a student walkout in Newark in 1970 in protest over the killings at Kent State. When I meet him at the West Hollywood Arcade, Jordan's father and namesake, Michael A. Jordan, a taciturn man in a slate-gray Nehru shirt, has recently returned from Zambia, where he was involved in building a water system for farmers, the continuation of his years-long interest in Africa. The senior Jordan, who goes by Tony, grew up in poverty-stricken South Central Los Angeles, one of six kids raised by a single mother, Dolores Jordan. His family paid regular visits to the U.S. organization, an educational and activist group started by Maulana Karenga and Hakeem Jamal that used the term us to mean blacks in the United States, which they sometimes referred to as United Slaves. It was Karenga who invented Kwanzaa as an African-American holiday. Jordan's family celebrated it throughout his childhood. In 1974, the elder Jordan joined the Marines and simultaneously became more deeply committed to the Pan-African movement, which has historically called for a degree of racial separatism, overlapping at times with the causes of the Black Panthers and rooted in a philosophy first formulated by Marcus Garvey. Garvey believed that racial parity would only be achieved if the African-American world developed its own saints and heroes and martyrs. And he encouraged black self-empowerment through business ownership. Donna had moved to California to live with a cousin and pursue her art when she met Tony in 1982 while he was working at his cousin's barbecue joint in Compton. They bonded in part over black politics and married in 1984. When Michael was born in Santa Ana, California in 1987, his parents gave him the middle name Bakari, Swahili for noble promise, and until he became an actor, Bakari was what his family called him. The Jordan family traces its lineage to a slave named Blackman, who married a Cherokee named Josephine. Her portrait hangs in Jordan's Aunt Janet's house in Los Angeles. When Jordan was an infant, his parents moved to New Jersey to live with Donna's formidable mother, Geneva Davis, who lived near a good school district in middle-class Montclair. "It's the lineage," says Donna. "Family is everything. You protect your family. You make sure that everyone is taken care of, you know." That structure was passed down from my grandmother and grandfather. Together, they were unbelievable, very political, always working for politics, working in the community, making sure everyone had what they needed. Her grandparents built a successful business in Venice, California in the 1940s. In Newark, the Jordan family eventually befriended Cory Booker, the city's mayor, now a senator from New Jersey. "My dad used to cater for him," said Jordan. "Me and Cory Booker, Ross Baraka, the current mayor, everybody, the Baraka family, they're all really good friends with my family." Michael B. Jordan's friends all characterize Jordan's father as militant, but they mean his child-rearing style as much as his politics. When his children misbehaved, he made them pick out their own tree branch from the yard to get switched. After Jordan got his driver's license and bought a BMW 330 CI with his acting money, he began hanging out in abandoned parking lots to race cars with illegal crews, made up of black and Latino teenagers who were into drifting, high-speed sliding. His parents didn't know about it. But when Jordan blew out his transmission one night, he called his father for help, resulting in a confrontation. "I was scared shitless," he says. "I knew I was going to get it." At this point, Jordan was still acting as Reggie in All My Children. For a split second, it was like, "I'm grown, I work, I make my own money. I can do this, you know. You guys can't tell me I got to be in at such and such or whatever it is." And I got checked. I got checked. I remember the first time you think you could challenge your father, and then you realize he's a grown-ass man, and you're 120 pounds soaking wet with a pocket full of nickels. We got closer because of it. And yeah, so I think that was another moment of just being young and smelling yourself and, okay, I'm grown. I wasn't grown. I didn't know everything. I didn't know shit. Every disciplinary ass-whooping that I got, every time I got reprimanded, everything, it all pays off. It all makes sense. I loved him for it. Michael B. Jordan views himself and his peers as the generational heirs to Will Smith and Denzel Washington. "They broke down those barriers for us," Jordan says. "Now it's time for us to take what they did and take it to the next level." In a New York Times dinner table interview with Denzel Washington and Michael B. Jordan, the older actor, coiled and skeptical, evinced a subtle paternalistic attitude toward the younger actor. When Jordan opined on the importance of international box office receipts and said he wanted the director of HBO's Fahrenheit 451, in which Jordan plays a villainous cop, to take his opinions seriously, Washington had to laugh. "Getting your big boy voice. There were no black superheroes when I was growing up," notes Washington. Jordan's best movies have all been directed by Ryan Coogler, who used Jordan's physical screen presence, his well-built body, his huge smile, the slow-burn vulnerability to maximal effect. Whether Jordan can achieve a wider range and depth under different direction, or whether he has reached the limits of his craft, remains to be seen. But he is attempting to convert his success into something that won't require him to be as brilliant on screen as Denzel Washington. He's turning himself into a business. Jordan reportedly made only $2 million on Black Panther, though he says he gets residuals on the back end as part of the financial structure of Marvel superhero movies. But he admits he was a rookie when he signed up for Panther and didn't yet command the money he can get now. "Moving forward, it's a totally different story," he says. "This is the defining moment in a lot of different areas for me that's going to set up my next 5 to 10. That's why I'm so locked in right now, because if it was ever a time to get distracted or, like, drop the ball, this is not it." In a film industry upended by Netflix and HBO, Jordan wants to leverage his fame into a commercial enterprise that gives him ownership of his own success and the power to break ground for black actors, directors, and producers in Hollywood. With 7.3 million Instagram followers and nearly a million Twitter followers, Jordan is quickly building a brand that includes new endorsement deals, a fast-growing production company, and a new marketing operation that will curate and target TV shows and movies to the same young, multicultural audiences who flocked to Black Panther. Jordan's budding company is modeled on those of his sports heroes, especially the Lakers' LeBron James, whose multimedia marketing and branding operation and TV production company is worth nearly $1 billion. Whenever I see James, it's love, always trying to represent our generation, representing our culture, like, why not us, says Jordan. Things don't have to be the way they've always been done. I just happen to do more than just act. Jordan talks a lot with the Jay-Z and LeBron teams and closely studies their operations. His chief ally and architect in building his own company is Philip Sun, a 36-year-old agent at William Morris Endeavor, who has assembled the most important roster of black talent in a generation, including Lena Waithe, Donald Glover, Idris Elba, John Boyega, and Letitia Wright. Michael's always had the ambition of being a brand from the get-go, says Sun, who recruited Jordan away from United Talent after the success of Fruitvale Station. Born to parents who immigrated from Taiwan, Sun grew up speaking Mandarin, graduated from William and Mary with a degree in international relations, and was working as an on-set assistant to Parker Posey when Steven Spielberg recommended he try becoming an agent. At 23, Sun became the youngest agent at the company after William Morris merged with Endeavor in 2009. He was advised early on to specialize and decided to focus on non-white actors, tutored by a pioneering black agent named Charles D. King, who'd represented Terrence Howard and Andre 3000. King left in 2015 to create his own production company devoted to actors of color called Macro, which recently produced the Boots Riley comedy Sorry to Bother You. That left Sun to build his own roster at WME. With the tutelage from Charles, and also just being a minority here, it was always important for me to fight for talent of color, because in some strange way I was fighting for myself, giving myself a voice, he says. The first Creed movie gave Jordan a kind of instant sports profile, leading to endorsement deals with Nike, Piaget watches, and of course Acura. It also laid the groundwork for a successful film franchise. Says Sun, you need your franchise because in order for him to achieve all the things that he had the ambition to do, we had to make him a star, a bona fide star. Sun and Jordan hope the 1-2 punch of Black Panther and Creed II coming out in the same year will solidify Jordan's stardom, but timing is critical. Creed II was fast-tracked to take advantage of the momentum of Black Panther. Shot in the course of a month last spring, edited over the summer, and at the time of this writing, still being readied for theaters for November. An insane schedule, says Jordan, who showed up in Philadelphia a month early to train and try building his body even bigger than before. I have to fit the storyline. The original idea for Creed was based on Coogler's relationship to his late father, with whom he bonded over the Rocky movies. Co-star Tessa Thompson says Coogler didn't conceive of Creed as a franchise, but Michael B. Jordan saw the potential instantly. Jordan says Coogler didn't direct Creed II, because the schedule for Black Panther made it untenable. Sly Stallone was initially slated to direct the sequel, but Coogler instead recommended Capel, a former classmate at University of Southern California Film School. Hovering over Creed II is a fear that cynical studio heads will start to think of Black Panther as a one-off that can't translate to other films starring black actors. Sun has explicitly told his clients, including Jordan, that the success of Black Panther will not necessarily smooth the path to more and better roles. By no means is this over. It's not even getting that much easier, Sun says. It's just more of a conversation now. And so Creed II is an important test case for Jordan to disprove, once again, the old studio cliché that black stars don't sell overseas. Nicolas Cage made so much money overseas, says Jordan. If you don't perform domestically and you can still make money internationally, you will always be around. That's why Creed II, is so important nowadays, this time around, because it is more international. Meanwhile, Jordan is quickly building on the momentum of Black Panther, ramping up his production company as an engine for movies and TV shows that will define his brand. They'll star not just himself, but also talent he personally recruits, especially black artists. I want to create projects for Brad Pitt, but at the same time, I want to be able to create a movie for Will Smith, or Denzel, or Lupita, or Tessa, says Jordan. It's going to be eclectic. It's going to be animation. It's going to be non-scripted. It's going to be digital. It's going to be film, television. It's going to be video games. Conversely, that means avoiding becoming an actor associated exclusively with politically charged black roles like Oscar Grant. After Fruitvale, Jordan started making clear he was interested in white male roles, by which he meant roles with universal appeal. Michael didn't want to be defined just by, "Let's send Michael all the race-related projects," says Sun, which is how the industry reacts to something like that. "We understand that Michael will get the African-American roles. I'll find them. The industry will find me. We'll just be presented those." It's about seeing ourselves as a colorblind talent, which he should be. With all these considerations about his brand and the arc of his career, often in conflict, picking roles has become more complicated. Sun says they analyze a role from every possible angle before making a decision. Jordan turned down the chance to produce and star in Monsters and Men, for instance, which is about the killing of a black man by the police. Jordan's personal interest remained the same as when he was 15, science fiction and comic books. But also, he says, films featuring strong women and black history. Last spring, after Frances McDormand called for more diversity on Hollywood sets, during her stirring Oscar speech, Jordan announced he'd use inclusion riders on all of his productions, a contractual commitment to employing racially and gender-diverse film crews. In September, Jordan convinced Warner Brothers to institute inclusion riders across the entire studio. Jordan has a lot on his plate. He is producing and starring in a sci-fi TV series called Raising Dion for Netflix, about a black boy with superpowers, co-produced with Charles D. King's Macro, and making a feature film called Just Mercy, about a passionate young lawyer representing death row inmates, co-starring Jamie Foxx and Brie Larson. He's also producing a coming-of-age TV series for Oprah's OWN network, currently titled David Makes Man, written by playwright Terrell Alvin McCraney, who co-wrote and produced the celebrated indie film Moonlight, and a historical epic about an all-black regiment during World War II called the Liberators, an idea Jordan's father tipped him to. Then there's Jordan's next movie with Ryan Coogler, Wrong Answer, about a notorious standardized testing scandal in Georgia, with a script by Ta-Nehisi Coates. Jordan is even preparing for his directorial debut with a film adaptation of the best-selling young adult novel, The Stars Beneath Our Feet, about a young black boy who finds hope as an obsessive Lego builder after his brother is killed by a gang. Jordan worries about how he will get Coogler and Coates and others to fit into his jam-packed schedule, but the collectivism of the company is part of Jordan's vision of black progress as a business plan. Unity is so important, Jordan says. You can just pick up the phone and get in contact with somebody and have an idea. No ego. What's up? You guys want to work together? Let's do something together. Meanwhile, Jordan is prepping a remake of one of his favorite movies, the classic heist picture, The Thomas Crown Affair, which originally starred Steve McQueen in 1968, and later Pierce Brosnan in a 1999 remake. Producing and directing black-centric projects while starring in roles that have traditionally gone to white actors is part of the design. This fall, Jordan will assemble a new marketing company with two childhood friends, including Sterling Brim, a former music manager who co-hosts the MTV program Ridiculousness. Philip Sun describes it as a cultural marketing and consulting group that can deliver young audiences of color to movie houses and TV screens through curated social media and music soundtracks. We feel like we have a pretty sound perspective and opinion on how to market certain things, especially to our culture, says Jordan. The first customer for the startup was Creed II. Sterling Brim curated the hip-hop soundtrack, which included Nas and Lil Wayne. Jordan plans on making a marketing contract with his company part of any deal he cuts with a studio. Any film deal, whether it be Warner Brothers or Netflix. The idea is for Jordan to collect a revenue stream from every part of the production, his studio salary, the production, the endorsements, the marketing, the product placements, the video games, the apps. Eventually, he wants to own all of his own content and be the CEO of what amounts to a mini studio. Making him a de facto Hollywood mogul. Our next step, says Sun, will be an umbrella company to finance all of the things we want to do, and then ultimately the long-term plan is for that umbrella company to own whatever content that he creates. That is a step for Michael and the team to becoming the mogul status that he wants to be. Before I fly to Los Angeles to meet Michael B. Jordan, he expresses concern to his representatives that Vanity Fair is sending a white reporter to profile him. He's been interviewed by plenty of white reporters, but he's also felt misunderstood and occasionally burned. When I ask him about this, Jordan says, there is an unspoken language between people of color, black men or whatever, because they just understand what it is, what it feels like. My intentions, when I say certain things, they know exactly what I mean, what I'm trying to say. And sometimes when you deal with journalists and writers who are trying to observe from the outside and what they think you're trying to say, it doesn't always connect. It's not always the same thing. While Jordan tries to get the predominantly white media to understand where he's coming from, he also has to manage his black fan base, who have very specific and passionate ideas about what a black man should be doing. Jordan recently went on a vacation to the Amalfi Coast in Italy, where he was captured by paparazzi riding in a motorboat with pal Sterling Brim and several white women in bikinis. The photos reignited a long-simmering rumor that Jordan prefers white women, a contentious issue for black celebrities dating back to Richard Pryor, who regularly explored the subject in stand-up routines. One critic on Twitter suggested they throw Jordan in the ocean with his ancestors. Jordan jumped on Instagram to try talking down the controversy, arguing to readers of The Shade Room, a black gossip site, that there simply weren't many black women in Italy, and that he liked all flavors of milk, including chocolate. "Y'all are bugging, teeing off on your boy, aight?" Not everyone bought his explanation. 2 years ago, Jordan used Instagram to put down gay rumors as well. "Navigating and learning how to deal with this shit, there's nobody that really helped me," he says, though he adds that he recently sought advice from Will Smith. There is a high degree of pressure on Michael B. Jordan to not screw this up. The career path, described by his agent as a narrow one, littered with leering paparazzi, an obsessive social media sphere, box office expectations, cultural misunderstandings, and the double standard for successful black men. I ask Jordan about the pressure to succeed, but also to make his community proud, his parents, friends, fellow actors and producers, the whole team he's propping up with jobs and roles and possibilities. "I think about that a lot," he says. "We're parked under a tree near Sunset Boulevard, and the racing is over. It's being the guy that has the opportunities and is in a position that can change the lives of a lot of people that you care about. It's a natural weight of not wanting to F up, you know what I'm saying? And not wanting, and that's why I overthink a little bit too much. Or I'm always thinking about..." He pauses to collect his thoughts. "I'm not comfortable yet, because the people around me aren't comfortable either. And it's like I gotta get to a place where I'm like, all right, the thing is moving on its own. The machine is running. You know what I'm saying? I can check in on maintenance every once in a while, but I gotta get the machine running, and I gotta keep pushing this boulder until I get some momentum. Once it starts to roll on its own, I can kinda start to live my life a little bit more, and that's the sacrifice that people don't really get. These people you see with these legacies, they don't ever talk about what they sacrificed to get there. People think these things just happen. It's not like that. They give up so much of their personal life, their love life, whatever, this, that, and personal things." This fall, Jordan is finally moving out of the house he's lived in with his parents for 2 years and into a penthouse in downtown Los Angeles, 3 blocks from the home of a friend in his entourage. Jordan says he has worked so hard and so intensely since he was 15, he's only managed to find personal space in recent months, often on open stretches of highway, usually at frightening speeds. "I enjoy life 160 miles per hour at a time," he says. He likes the sound of that and smiles. In a way, Denzel Washington was right. Jordan is finding his voice. And his mother, Donna, is already worried. "He's crazy," she says. "He's real crazy." "I think you can let him go now," his father says, breaking into a smile. "He's done pretty well." the Y Squad. The world's most elite counterterrorism unit has long kept its missions and tactics closely held secrets. Now the Yamam Commandos of Israel have decided to share their strategies and their hidden history. By Adam Shirelsky. Opening photo, location, Tel Aviv, Israel. Date, December 2017. Yamam repellers simulate retaking a skyscraper from terrorist. I pursued my enemies and overtook them. I did not turn back until they were destroyed. Psalm 18:37, motto of Israel's clandestine counter-terror squad. Next photo, location near Tel Aviv, Israel. Date, March 1978. The aftermath of a bus assault by PLO guerrillas, which claimed the lives of 37 Israelis and wounded 71. On a spring evening in late April, I traveled to a fortified compound in the Ayalon Valley between Tel Aviv and Jerusalem. The location is not identified on Waze, the Israeli-built navigation tool, and so, as far as my app-addled cab driver was concerned, it does not exist. Then again, the same could be said for its inhabitants. Yamam, a band of counter-terror operatives whose work over the last four decades has been shrouded in secrecy. Upon arrival at the group's headquarters, which has all the architectural warmth of a supermax, I made my way past a phalanx of Israeli border police in dark green battle dress uniforms and into a blast-proof holding pen where my credentials were scanned, my electronic devices were locked away, and I received a lecture from a counterintelligence officer who was nonplussed that I was being granted entree to the premises. "Do not reveal our location," he said. "Do not show our faces, and do not use our names." Then he added, grimly, and without a hint of irony, "Try to forget what you see." Yamam is the world's most elite and busiest force of its kind, and its expertise is in high demand in an era when ISIS veterans strike outside their remaining Middle East strongholds and self-radicalized lone wolves emerge to attack Western targets. Today, after Barcelona, says Gilad Erden, who for the past 3 years has been Israel's Minister for Public Security, after Madrid, after Manchester, after San Bernardino, everyone needs a unit like Yamam. More and more, the world's top intelligence and police chiefs are calling on Yamam, a Hebrew acronym that means Special Police Unit. During his first month on the job, recalls Erdan, I got requests from 10 countries to train together. I made my way to the office of Yamam's 44-year-old commander, whose name is classified. I am therefore obliged to refer to him by an initial, N, as if he were a Bond character. N's eyes are different colors, the result of damage sustained during a grenade blast. His shaved head and hulking frame give him the vibe of a Jewish Vin Diesel. At his side, he keeps an unmuzzled, unbelievably vicious Belgian shepherd named Django. Last fall, Israeli officials agreed to provide Vanity Fair unprecedented access to some of Yamam's activities, facilities, and undercover commandos. When I ask N why his superiors had chosen to break with their predecessors' decades of silence, he gave an uncharacteristically sentimental response. It's important for operators' families to hear about our successes. Field operators, as they are called, are exclusively male. Women sometimes serve in intelligence roles. N does not discount less magnanimous reasons for cooperating, however. First, Yamam has devised new methodologies for responding to terrorist incidents and mass shootings, which it is sharing with its counterparts across the globe. More on this shortly. Second, Israel, as an occupying power, faces international condemnation for its heavy-handed approach toward the Palestinians. As a result, some top officials evidently felt it was time to reveal the fact that governments, including a few of Israel's more vocal critics on the world stage, often turn to them sotto voce for help with their most intractable security problems. And last come the bragging rights, perhaps the unit's most meaningful rationale. Yamam, it so happens, recently won a bitter 40-year bureaucratic battle with Sayeret Matkal, a secretive special forces squad within the Israel Defense Forces, IDF. Sayeret Matkal was formerly the ne plus ultra in this realm. Indeed, Vanity Fair, in an article published right after the 9/11 attacks, called the group the most effective counterterrorism force in the world. It counts among its alumni, political leaders, military generals, and key figures in Israel's security establishment. And yet, when Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, a Sayeret Matkal veteran, had to quietly designate one unit to be the National Counterterror A-Team, he chose Yamam over his old contingent, which specializes in long-distance reconnaissance and complex overseas missions. Netanyahu's decision, supported by some of the Prime Minister's fiercest foes, had all the sting of President Barack Obama's selection of the Navy's SEAL Team 6 over the Army's Delta Force to conduct the 2011 raid on Osama bin Laden's compound in Abbottabad, Pakistan. Yamam is part of the National Police Force, not the military or the Mossad, which is Israel's CIA, or the Shin Bet, the country's domestic security service, which is more akin to Britain's MI5. And yet, in recent months, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict has blurred some of the lines between these agencies' duties. Yamam's primary focus involves foiling terror plots, engaging militants during attacks, combating crime syndicates, and blunting border incursions. In contrast, the military, in addition to protecting Israel's security, is often called upon to respond to West Bank demonstrations, using what human rights activists often consider excessive force. But as Hamas has continued to organize protest along the fence that separates Israel and Gaza, IDF snipers have been killing Palestinians, who tend to be unarmed. What's more, Hamas has sent weaponized kites and balloons into Israel, along with mortar and rocket barrages, prompting devastating IDF airstrikes. While members of the Yamam have participated in these missions as well, they have largely played a secondary role. For every terrorist attack in Israel that makes the news, there are 10 that are prevented. Off and on for a year, I followed N and his team as they traveled, trained, and exchanged tactics with their American, French, and German counterparts on everything from retaking passenger trains to thwarting complex attacks from cadres of suicide bombers and gunmen firing rocket-propelled grenades. Yamam's technology, including robots and throwbots, cameras housed in round casings that upright themselves upon landing, is dazzling to the uninitiated. But so are the stats. Yamam averages some 300 missions a year. According to N, his commandos have stopped at least 50 ticking time bombs, suicide bombers en route to their targets, and hundreds of attacks at earlier stages. I've been out with the imam on operations. John Miller, the New York Police Department's Deputy Commissioner of Intelligence and Counterterrorism, told me in his office, a few blocks from the World Trade Center. There are a lot of outfits that have a lot of knowledge and do a lot of training, but that's different from a lot of experience. He pointed out that for every terrorist attack in Israel that makes the news, there are 10 that are prevented by imam acting on perishable intelligence provided by Shin Bet. Avi Dichter agrees wholeheartedly. After serving in Sayeret Matkal, he joined the Shin Bet and in 2000 rose to become its directors. He now chairs the Committee on Defense and Foreign Affairs in the Knesset, Israel's parliament. For years, he admitted, counterterrorism officials shared only a portion of their most sensitive intelligence with covert operatives, out of fear of its being compromised. Now, Dichter says, imam representatives sit in Shin Bet's war room to ensure they have the full picture. It took us a long time to understand that you can't keep information from the unit you're asking to perform a mission, because what they don't know may undermine the entire operation. When I asked him how he would describe the unit to outsiders, he said, imam is a special operations force that has the powers of the police, the capabilities of the military, and the brains of Shin Bet. They are, in effect, the spy agency's soldiers. The NYPD's Miller, for his part, claimed U.S. law enforcement agencies benefit from imam's successes. A former journalist who once interviewed bin Laden, Miller maintained, you can learn a lot from the imam about tactics, techniques, and procedures that, when adapted, can work in any environment, including New York. It's why we go to Israel once or twice a year, not just to see what we've seen before, but to see what we've seen before that they're doing differently. Because terrorism, like technology, and sometimes because of technology, is constantly evolving. If you're working on the techniques you developed 2 years ago, you're way out of date. Kirstjen Nielsen, Trump's Secretary of Homeland Security, concurs. We have a lot to learn from Israel, imam in particular, in terms of how they use technology as a force multiplier to combat an array of threats. Over the last 15 years, we at DHS have partnered with them on almost every threat. A new paradigm. I saw a few Hollywood movies about fighting terrorism and terrorist, N said, but the reality is beyond anything you can imagine. Back in the States, I trailed him and his entourage, who met with the L.A. County Sheriff's Department's Special Enforcement Bureau, as well as New York City's Emergency Service Unit, which falls under Miller. Terror organizations used to take hostages because they wanted to achieve a prisoner exchange. Now they're trying to do something different, N observed, remembering a bygone era when terrorism was a violent means of achieving more concrete political ends. The conventional wisdom for how to deal with fast-moving terrorist incidents has evolved over time, most notably in hostage situations. Since the 1960s and 70s, first responders have sought to establish a physical boundary to contain an event, engage the perpetrators in dialogue, draw out negotiations while formulating a rescue plan, then move in with a full team. Similar principles were adapted for reacting to kidnappers, emotionally disturbed individuals, and mass casualty incidents. But over the last 20 years, a period that dovetails with N's rise from recruit to commander, he and his colleagues have come to treat terror attacks the way doctors treat heart attacks and strokes. There is a golden window in which to intervene and throw all their energy and resources at the problem. While units in the U.S. have tended to arrive on the scene, gauge the situation, secure a perimeter, and then call in specialists or reinforcements. Your mom goes in heavy, dispatching self-contained squadrons of breachers, snipers, repellers, bomb techs, dog handlers, and hostage negotiators. Metaphorically speaking, they don't send an ambulance to stabilize a patient for transport. They send a hospital to ensure survival on scene. Moreover, they establish mobile units with clear lines of authority, not an array of groups with competing objectives. These teams can rove and respond, and are not unduly tethered to a central command base. The active shooter changed everything, John Miller elaborated. Nowadays, the terrorist or mass murderer isn't interested in negotiations or even survival. He is looking for maximum lethality and to achieve martyrdom in many cases. Because of this, the response team's priorities have shifted. The primary objective, said Miller, echoing Yamam's strategy, is to stop the killing. That means to use the first officers on the scene, whether they're specialized or not. The other part is to stop the dying. How do you then set parameters inside as the people are chasing the threat, going after the sound of gunfire, engaging the gunman? How do you get to those people who are wounded, who are still viable, who could survive? American law enforcement has struggled with this since the Columbine case, when responders waited too long to storm in. We've got to get inside within 20 minutes. It can't be within the golden 2 hours, or it's not golden. Major O, the 37-year-old who commands Imam's sniper team, explained that one of the unit's signature skills is getting into the assailant's mindset. We try to learn every terrorist attack everywhere in the world to find out how we can do it better, he noted. Our enemies are very professional, too, and in the end, they are learning. They try to be better than us. To maintain its edge, Yamam, after analyzing far-flung incidents, fashions its training to address possible future attacks. In the time that I spent with the operators, they rappelled down a Tel Aviv skyscraper and swooped into an office dozens of floors below, testing alternative ways that responders might have confronted last year's Las Vegas attack, in which a lone gunman on the 32nd floor of the Mandalay Bay Hotel fired more than 1,000 rounds at concertgoers, killing 58. A Yamam squad also spent hours on a dimly lit platform taking over a stationary Israeli passenger train, alongside members of France's elite Groupe d'Intervention de la Gendarmerie Nationale. The French had come to Israel, in part, to practice such maneuvers. Evidently mindful of 2015's Talis rail attack, which recently found its way to the big screen in Clint Eastwood's The 1517 to Paris. And at a telecommunications facility north of Tel Aviv, Israeli operatives simulated a nighttime mission with Germany's vaunted Grundschutz Group 9, facing multiple gunmen and explosions in all directions. Taking it all in, I felt like I had unwittingly been cast as an extra in a Michael Bay movie. As they briefed their European guest, the Imam team preached its gospel of never allowing the perfect to be the enemy of the good. To be relevant and to win this battle, sometimes you must go with 50% or 70% knowledge and intelligence, N said. As he considered what his counterparts faced at places such as Orlando's Pulse nightclub or the Bataclan concert hall in Paris, N asserted that in today's scenarios, unlike those in the 20th century, we don't have the privilege of time. You must come inside very fast, because there are terrorists that are killing hostages every minute. Next photo. Location, Dimona, Israel. Date, March 1988. The so-called Mother's Bus attack, in which three nuclear research workers were executed by PLO terrorists. The second directive. The inside story of Yamam's genesis has not been told by its leaders until now. In 1972, during the Summer Olympics in Munich, members of the Palestinian group Black September kidnapped and murdered 11 Israeli teammates. The cold-blooded attack and Germany's botched response prompted Israel's Prime Minister Golda Meir to initiate Operation Wrath of God, sending hit squads to track down and kill the group's organizers and others, later depicted in Steven Spielberg's Munich. And though it may have escaped public attention, a secret second directive would go forth as well, which ordered the establishment of a permanent strike force to deter or defeat future attacks. This mandate would not be realized until 2 years later, after terrorists sneaked across the border from Lebanon, killed a family of three, and took over an elementary school in Mala with 105 students and 10 teachers inside, hoping to negotiate for the release of their brethren held in Israeli prisons. Sayrat Matkal raced to the scene and mounted a disastrous rescue attempt. 21 students perished. Addressing the Knesset, Meir exclaimed, "The blood of our children, the martyrs of Mailat, cries out to us, exhorting us to intensify our war against terrorism, to perfect our methods." Following the attack, counterterrorism responsibilities, especially the delicate art of hostage rescue, shifted from the IDF to a new police unit, initially dubbed the Fist Brigade. And later, Yamam. Chronically underfunded, ostracized by the military, and deemed an unknown quantity by the intelligence services, the unit was a backwater. That is, until Asaf Heifetz was put in charge. He was a well-regarded IDF paratrooper with important friends, among them future Prime Minister Ehud Barak. Heifetz had supported the April 1973 operation in which Barak, famously disguised as a woman, infiltrated Beirut and killed several Palestinian Liberation Organization leaders as part of Israel's ongoing retaliation for Munich. Heifetz professionalized Yamam, persuading skilled soldiers to join his new police commando unit, whose work was a secret to all but a handful of Israelis. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service and broadcasting from its Raleigh, North Carolina studios. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selection by Mark Hoffman.